All right. As typical, my dad gave me the section that is longer than all the other sections to cover in one night. And you guys know how good I am at keeping things short and never going long. I never do that. So we aren't going to be able to read everything tonight. Chapter 35 is the shortest of these, and we will go ahead and read this chapter, and then we'll just skim through the next two chapters and talk about some things. But I want to do a little bit of an illustration tonight as well and spend some time on that to make some practical application out of what we're talking about tonight. But to go ahead and do chapter 35, can I get a volunteer for a reader to go ahead and read chapter 35, which is 16 verses? Yeah, Kevin, go ahead. Okay, thank you, Kevin. So this first section, verses 1 through 8, and I've got my notes. My dad's notes are up here. I probably won't reference those at all, so if I get way behind on the PowerPoint, that's sorry. But it's hard to teach from someone else's notes, and so I'm just going to go ahead and use my own. But in verses 1 through 8, God is being portrayed as Elihu as so great that he's not obligated to us, and he's not obligated by anything in which we do. And he starts off this section very proud, and well, to begin with, there's a difference in verse 2 from the New American Standard and the NIV, when he talks about that God has made me righteous, or God sees me as righteous, and then the NIV says that God will vindicate me. So there's a little bit of a difference there. But Elihu is going to bring up something that we actually don't see recorded anywhere so far. In verse 3, it says, "What advantage have I, and how am I better off than if I had sinned?" What's interesting is Job, in everything that we've read so far, we don't read Job saying anything like that. It could be a reference to what Job said in chapter 7, verse 20, or perhaps chapter 9, verses 29 through 31. And we see a similar thing in Elihu's words in chapter 34, verse 9, when he said, "It profits a man nothing that he should delight in God." And he's talking about what Job has said. And that's basically a commentary, this is how we should understand it, of what Elihu understands Job to have said. That it doesn't matter whether you're righteous or whether you're unrighteous, that God is not really listening and that God is not really paying attention. Now, Elihu is going to make a comment similar to that, but it seems to be a correction of what Job has said. Notice verse 4, and this is very interesting. This is a young guy talking, remember, in the midst of older men and amongst Job, who's older than him. And he basically says, "Listen up, because I'm going to instruct you guys. You don't really know what you're talking about, and so I'm going to give you the answer." That does not necessarily mean that he's incorrect. Sometimes one who is younger is correct, and one who is older is not, because one has an understanding from God and the other does not. But it seems really arrogant. But his point is, look at verses 6 and 7. He says, if you've sinned, what do you accomplish against him? And if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? And if you are righteous, what do you give him, or what does he receive from your hand? And here's really Elihu's point. You are not going to change who God is, whether you're righteous or whether you're wicked. God is God, regardless of what you do. And if you're wicked, you don't keep God from acting. And if you're righteous, you don't make God any better than what he already is. It's kind of like the term that Paul uses, that if we are not faithful, yet he is still faithful. And that it doesn't really matter on his end. It's not any better or worse whether or not we are better or worse. God is God regardless of whether we serve him or not. And so his whole point in this section, really, to kind of go through it quickly, is really summed up in verse 8. Your wickedness concerns a man like yourself, and your righteousness a son of man. His point here really is that these situations we're talking about, moral actions, they have pertinence to fellow man, whether they be wicked actions or whether they be righteous actions, but it really has no consequence to God. Now, some of what Elihu, I think, is saying is true in principle, but I would argue with Elihu to an extent as well. Here's Elihu's general principle, which I think is true. It doesn't matter whether you honor God or whether you dishonor God. God is still God, and God's word will come true, no matter whether you adhere to it or not. But where I think Elihu is going to falter is in saying that basically that it doesn't concern God. God is concerned with the actions of man, and we see that through the words of David. What is man that you are mindful of him? And that's a positive statement. God is mindful. But Elihu's point seems to be simply that God is not obligated to us. And that's going to set up his next argument that we're going to see. Because he's going to discuss that the reason God is not answering man is because of man's pride and because man is sinful, and therefore God does not hear the prayer of a sinner. He begins in verse 9 talking about the people being oppressed and the people being weighed down, and so therefore they're calling out. And it's very similar to what we read about in the period of the judges, or when you read about the people in Egypt. Remember that it was that God had heard the cry of his people and they were oppressed, and they were calling out to God for deliverance because they were oppressed. Here Elihu's using the same language, but what he's saying here is though they're crying out for help, none are actually truly crying out for God like they should. He says none are saying, "Where is God my maker?" But instead, because of their pride, because they are calling out to him and yet they aren't calling out from the heart, because they're still sinful, God is not going to hear their cry. He's not going to deliver them. He's going to allow them to be oppressed. Think about it like this. Remember when we were going through Proverbs class, and in Proverbs chapter 1, wisdom is personified, and wisdom is calling out at the gates and is calling out to people, to the simple-minded and to the youth, to come in and to listen. And but then later in chapter 1, it says, "But if you scoff and if you mock, and then calamity strikes you, and you call out, I will not listen." It's that simple principle of what comes around goes around. In Luke's version of the Beatitudes, Luke records the Lord saying, "Blessed are you who mourn now and weep now, for you shall laugh. But woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep." It's the same kind of principle that Elihu is trying to bring out. The time that they're crying out for God, he's not going to answer because it's too late. Their pride has allowed them to fall to the depths that they have, and therefore, you're going to basically have your cake and eat it too. You made your bed, and now you're going to lay in it, is Elihu's point. And now he's going to bring attention to Job specifically, because he turns his attention to Job, I believe, here in verse 14. Because Job over and over again has said that he does not see God. And by that he means that he doesn't see God's actions. Job over and over again has stated that God is turning a blind eye to sin. That God does not do anything about those who are sinful. And that was when Job was trying to counter-argue his friends, who said, the reason you're suffering, Job, is because you're a sinful person. But Job's counter-argument was, look at all these people who are blessed, and yet they're sinful. God has not done anything about it. Elihu's confronting that point. And he says, you are so incorrect for stating that God does not do anything about the sinful and does not do anything about the oppressed. And we're going to see that from Elihu in the next chapter. In verse 15, it says, verse 14, notice over and over again how Job before has talked about that I'm bringing my case before God, and I stand before God, though I might die, I demand an audience with God. Elihu is going to specifically address this as one of his main arguments to Job and how Job has faltered in chapter 37. And that's the main point I want us to get tonight. So hold on to that verse. And Elihu finishes up this section by basically saying, Job, you don't know what you're talking about when you're saying these things. When you demand an audience with God, and when you claim that you know that God is not acting but is turning a blind eye, you can't do these things. Any thoughts or questions about chapter 35 before we move on? Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
Seeing him as you are created by this ultimate being, now you're demanding that he release you from whatever pain you're going through.
Okay, perfect. And that is definitely going to be his argument. I mean, that is his argument to Job later, which is saying when you understand God and how great God is, you think you can demand an audience with a God like him? And absolutely not. And so Elihu's point isn't necessarily like his friend stating, Job, you're a sinner because you've done these things that they couldn't name or that they made up. But he's saying, Job, you're a sinner because you're arrogant and because you're proud. And because you're proud, God is not going to answer you. And it's the same similar concept to Proverbs 1 like we were discussing, where you know what you should do, you know what you shouldn't do, you don't listen to wisdom, and yet you call out later, assuming that though you were warned so much, that now you can just, you know, march on in and at the last minute allow wisdom to save you. Not focusing on the sin, focusing on the pride. It's the same attitude as, you know, have you met people that have said, you know, I'll get my life right with God towards the end of my life. You know, I'll just live my life the way I want to, and then I can obey the gospel later. That doesn't work that way, because how proud is it to assume in the first place that God does not see right through that kind of a heart? That you can live your life the way you want to, and then when you're ready on your terms, you come to God, and He's going to deliver you and save you. If nothing else is wrong with that, it's the same proud attitude and the same proud arrogance. All right, chapter 36. Elihu is going to defend his right to speak on God's behalf, beginning with verse 1. And notice his language here. He says, "Bear with me a little while, and I will show you, for I have something to say on God's behalf. For I get my knowledge from afar, and ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." Now, Elihu is not claiming that he is perfect in knowledge. Don't misunderstand what he said there. He's claiming the one who is perfect in knowledge, which is God. What I'm about to share with you is his wisdom, and so therefore it is as though God is with you. The one who is perfect in knowledge right now is with you. He's acting as a messenger, he states, on God's behalf. But it's interesting because Job's friends before this have said, "This is the way of God," and proceeded to tell Job what he ought to do. And then Job has replied back, "No, this is, you know, the way of God," and has, you know, responded back to them. So now Elihu is jumping on the God train and saying, "No, I'm the one who knows what God will say. And I'm the one who is going to represent and speak on God's behalf." And this is really a moment of dramatic irony. Because what Elihu is about to say through the rest of chapter 36 and 37 is basically that God is so great that no one could possibly know all of his thoughts and know all of his ways and understand what he does. And yet to begin this section stating that no one can really know all of God's thoughts or all of God's ways, he prefaces it by saying, "I'm going to speak on God's behalf because this is his way." You see the irony there? It's a little bit ironic and a little bit arrogant. But to be fair, at least in my understanding, all of what Elihu says in chapter 36 is not incorrect and is correct. Some of what he says is wrong, as we'll look at the end of the class. I know Wayne has asked about that. But some of what he says is right. And most of chapter 36 is absolutely correct. So he continues on, and this is going to be the new perspective that we haven't heard yet. And his perspective in verses 5 through 15 is that God uses affliction to teach us and to instruct us and to bring us back to him. And I don't know a better sound biblical argument that one could make at this point in the book of Job. We see that throughout scriptures, that God sometimes uses suffering and pain and things like that to bring us closer to him. Think about what Paul says to the Corinthians. I'm sorry that I made you sorrowful, but I'm not sorry that I made you sorrowful, because godly sorrow leads to repentance. The whole point of that is that there was some kind of discipline that took place, and God used that for the purpose of maturing you and bringing you closer to him. That is Elihu's argument, because we haven't heard that up to this point. We've heard you're suffering because you're a sinner, and that's the reason God is using affliction, is because you're a sinner, and therefore God is causing you to suffer. We've also heard, no, God doesn't do anything to the sinners, and he turns a blind eye. Elihu's point here is that God can use suffering and affliction to teach us lessons, whether you're a sinner or not. Okay, JC. Right.
The first couple of trials, he, you know, praised God, praised God. But then when things got truly bad, the friends came in, all of a sudden there was no more of Job praising God. He didn't blaspheme necessarily, but he didn't humble himself. Wouldn't that in and of itself make him technically a sinful person, as the friends claim, that he was currently not glorifying God and therefore sinning?
Perhaps, but not in the way that the friends accused Job. Because what they were saying is, Job, you neglected the widows. And Job, you took advantage of the orphans. And Job, you did this with your daughters. And Job, you did this with your sons. They were just making blind statements. Elihu does a better job here. He says, Job, your sin is your pride. Your sin is your arrogance. And so Elihu actually comes a little closer to the truth in the case of Job, if that helps to answer your question there. Beginning in verse 5, Elihu states, "Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right." This is in direct contrast to Job's idea that he expressed in chapter 21 and in verse 7, where Job stated that why do the wicked live and reach old age and grow mighty in power? Job was saying, I see wicked people and they don't suffer, they aren't punished. Elihu is contrasting that and saying, no, the wicked are not kept alive, but they are going to be given what they deserve. And whether or not Elihu is calling Job wrong, or whether he is trying to speak in a more spiritual term in the long run, is kind of unclear. But it seems to be in direct contrast to what Job has already said. Skipping down to verses 8 and 9, this is the crux of his argument here. He says, if they're bound in chains and caught in the cords of affliction, then he declares them to work and their transgressions, that they are behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. But if they do not listen, they will perish by the sword and die without knowledge. If you picked up in verse 9 again, the transgression here is arrogance. And the transgression here is pride and acting in pride in regards to God. But in verse 10, notice his argument here. God is trying to open the ears of the proud in order to allow them to return to him. This is what makes Elihu's argument here so powerful. He's stating the purpose for affliction and the purpose for correction is often to teach us and to bring us closer to God. That the whole purpose of this, all of these trials and everything that Job has gone through is to bring Job back to him and return Job to God, or return man to himself in general. It's very similar to something that you hear Eliphaz say in chapter 5 when he discusses the outcome, that if they listen, they'll be prosperous, but if they don't, they'll be destroyed. But overall, that is a correct statement from Eliphaz. And if you look at Deuteronomy 28 29 and 30, God's whole point is, if you listen to my words, these blessings will come. But if you reject my words, this is going to be the outcome. That's Elihu's statement here, is that God is using discipline and is using hardship to bring you back to him. So listen and do what God has said and it will be well. But if you continue in your pride and you continue in your arrogance and you don't call on God and you don't return to him, then the only thing you're going to see is destruction. And that's a true statement. And we're going to see him address those who are too proud to even call on God later on in the text. In verse 13... and 14, we have some interesting language here. And this is his immediate point that we were just talking about. Verse 13, the godless in heart cherish anger, and they do not cry for help when he binds them. Elihu is describing someone who is so proud that it doesn't matter how low they get, they will refuse to turn to God for help and refuse to turn to God for aid. And you might have known people like that in your life. It doesn't matter what happens, they still will reject God and they will never accept the possibility of him or the possibility of how great he is in their life. And he brings this up and says they are godless in heart. They refuse to even cry out to him. And because of that, They die in their youth, and their life ends among the cult prostitutes. In that day, and you can read about this in 1 Kings chapter 14, chapter 15, chapter 22, chapter 23, and also in Genesis 38 and Hosea 4. It was a common practice of the Gentile religions to worship their gods in a cultish way, in which you would go into the temple and you would have commit an adultery or fornication with the prostitutes, and that's how you worshiped your god. And that was your right worship towards your god. This is the depiction that Elihu is giving of the one who is godless in heart and refuses to cry out to God. It appears, from my understanding of the text, that when he mentions their cult prostitutes, it's not necessarily condemnation on that practice, even though, of course, we know that that practice was wrong. He's showing that they're calling out to their gods, but they aren't going to answer. They're willing to call out to these other gods, but they're so proud in heart that they refuse to call out to the God, if that makes any sense. That's what Elihu's point here is. And so, therefore, because of this, verse 15, he's going to sum up his argument. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ears by adversity. He's saying, Job, here's what God's purpose in your suffering is. Here's his hope. That by adversity and by suffering, he will bring you out of your suffering. He'll bring you out of your pride if you're willing to turn to him. These things will go away if you turn to God and are not proud. And that God can deliver us through suffering and teach us lessons through these different types of things, whether you're righteous or unrighteous. So to speak, God uses suffering as a megaphone to teach us different lessons sometimes. Verses 16 through 21, he's going to speak more specifically of the purpose of God's discipline to Job precisely. And if you will turn down to verse, well, let's just read this section. But he says, he also allured you out of distress and into a broad place where there was no cramping, and what was set on your table was full of fatness. But you are full of judgment on the wicked, and judgment and justice seize you. Beware lest wrath entice you into scoffing, and let not the greatness of the ransom turn you aside. Will your cry for help avail to keep you from distress, or all the force of your strength? Do not long for the night when people vanish in their place. Remember Job earlier had said that he wished he was dead and wished he could die? Elihu's saying, don't you even dare say that. Don't dare say that you wish for death. Instead, verse 21, take care and do not turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction. Behold, God is exalted in power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has prescribed for him his way, or who can say you have done wrong? So far, Job has, when we first saw Job, and his wife said, do you still hold fast to your integrity, curse God and die? And his response is, shall we not accept good from the Lord and not also accept adversity? Or accept, you know, hardship from the Lord? That was his original thought process. But then as we've seen Job later on, he's developed this idea of, God, I demand an audience with you. Where are you? Because I don't deserve this. I'm righteous. And I don't know why this is happening. I want to know why this is happening. And so Elihu is calling him on this. He's saying, you have chosen to turn to iniquity rather than to choose affliction. And it's not necessarily talking about that you've chosen to go into some kind of a sinful practice. But he's saying, you're choosing this comfort of this pride within you in demanding to not be moved rather than accepting what God is giving to you to humble you and to bring you down. And so many times in our life, It is so easy to accept comfort instead of discipline. Suffering can be a teacher for us, except for it is so easy to reject that suffering because we would rather be comfortable. And this is Elihu's point really for Job, is you're not willing to accept what God is giving to you right now. First off, you did, and you said, shall we not accept affliction from the Lord? But you've gotten away from that, and you need to get back to that, Job. Beginning in verse 22 through 26, I want to just summarize the rest of chapter 36 without reading all of it. I want to read verse 26. It said, behold, God is great, and we know him not, and the number of his years is unsearchable. Elihu is going to go into this long monologue about how great God is. Verses 22 through 26 are specifically how God is exalted in power and how God is an independent sovereign that is not accountable to anyone. Who is going to talk to God and say, you're wrong, or why did you do this, or who have you thought about, or any of these things? No one can approach God and ask him anything, is Elihu's point. God is so great and so powerful that none dare approach him to ask anything. And then he's going to use the example of God's glory as we're being revealed in a thunderstorm. Remember when the children of Israel were at the foot of Mount Sinai and the Lord spoke out? What did the children of Israel say to that? And ask Moses to say to God. Yeah. Please tell God to stop speaking because we think we're all going to die. The glory of God was so great, and I wish I'd have put this picture up there. It happened in Chile, but there was this volcanic eruption recently. I think it was in Chile. And there was these amazing photographs taken of the mountain erupting, and there's these huge thunder clouds surrounding the mountain, and lightning is everywhere. And you could just imagine that kind of an awesome picture. That's what was going on at Sinai. And that is just a very small, insignificant glimpse at the glory and grandeur and awesome power of God. And the people were like, we don't want to hear God. We think we're going to die. Yeah, JC. The voice.
The description that he just gave, and now knowing what's coming up, means that in the background, that exact scene is forming behind him.
Right.
So as he's talking about this, he's got an example of it building up slowly behind him.
Right. And I hadn't even thought of that. Perhaps he's pointing to these thunder clouds that are coming and saying, consider the thunder and consider the lightning. And a lot of gods were considered to be the gods of lightning. Of course, Zeus was depicted with a lightning bolt in his hand. But also, anytime you dig up a Baal, a lot of times Baal is depicted with a bolt of lightning in his hand. And so it's really interesting. Remember the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel with Elijah? What were they claiming Baal could do to the altar? They were saying Baal could send down fire and consume the altar. I'm just, my opinion, understanding how they thought about Baal, and then understanding what we know about God and that God is the one in control of the elements of this world. I think that was talking about a lightning strike that came down from heaven and absolutely consumed the altar. They thought Baal was the god of the heavens, the god of lightning that would send down fire. There's no word for lightning in the Hebrew. It's fire. And so that's just my own interpretation. But yeah, Roy.
Verse 27 talks about evaporation.
Right.
They don't know what it is.
What's that?
At this time, they did not know about evaporation.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to ask, how did Elihu really get an understanding of what he's talking about in verse 27? Because this is a reference to the water cycle, basically. And he draws up drops of water, and they distill in the midst of his reign. So yeah, that's a really interesting point. But the great point of Elihu here is that God is so great and is so powerful. Job, how can you possibly walk up to this God and demand a court case with him? And demand an audience with him? You have no right to go to this God and demand such an audience. And I appreciate the picture of the people of Israel, because that's going to be actually the response of Job when God does show up and appear before Job. Job's going to fall back, and he's going to realize that I had no right to demand this of God. Chapter 37, he's going to go on, and he's going to describe the greatness of God, continuing with the lightning imagery. But then he's going to go on to talk about other weather instances in verse 4. After it, his voice roars, he thunders with a majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice, and he does great things that we cannot comprehend. God is so great, and God is so powerful. It's similar to Isaiah's words, his ways are not our ways, and his thoughts are not our thoughts. That's Elihu's point. Go down to verse 13. Whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. This is referring to all these different weather patterns that he's talked about. Think about how often God used weather to either curse or bless a nation. Genesis chapter 6, God decided to use the natural elements and weather to make a judgment upon man, and that was, of course, the flood. What about Egypt? How many of those plagues were God using the weather and his control over it to judge Egypt and do things to them? You see the hail, you see darkness over the land, the fact that the sea divided and then God caused it to fall upon itself. But then you see God using weather to bless his people, and for love is his point. You see instances in 1 Kings 8 or 18 where God causes rain to fall on the land and bless the land and deliver the people in that sense. But he goes through this whole description of God's power and God's might over the weather and how God can restrict human activity. Even the most resolute of humans or animals, God can restrict them with just his control over the weather. And his whole point begins in verse 14, where he says, "Stop and consider the wondrous works of God." You're going to see a lot of this language that is going to prepare God for his speeches, where Elihu will say things like, "Do you know?" or "Can you know?" or "Stop and consider." Very things that the Lord himself is going to use and is going to talk about. And he goes through to describe different things about the wondrous works of God, and he's questioning Job like God is going to question Job. Do you know when God has done this? Or can you explain how God has done this? And of course, the answer is that he cannot know. Verse 23, "The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." And that gets back to what we were talking about earlier. Elihu's point to Job is, you've been wise in your own eyes, you've been proud, you do not understand the God that we're dealing with here. And I want to end with just an illustration. I don't have time to bring someone up, but this is one of my favorite arguments when talking with an atheist. Because atheists claim that there is no such thing as God, you're foolish to believe in God, you cannot know God, but Elihu brings out some points here about not knowing the wondrous works of God. And in 2 minutes, if you want to turn an atheist into an agnostic, this is your argument. This circle represents all the knowledge that there possibly is to know, period. Now, if you are going to have someone come up and fill out what they think they know out of all knowledge there is, how big do you think that might be?
You couldn't
see it. Yeah, right? Well, in one of the debates where an atheist was doing this, he came up and he filled out this much. This is how much he knows out of all the knowledge there is to know, period. regardless of whether or not that's too big of a section, here's your argument. So you're claiming that in all of this here, this is things that you, that exist and that are, but you just have not found them yet. And the answer is yes, that's correct. I have this knowledge, this is all the knowledge there is, but I haven't found this yet. So you're claiming that there are things that exist, but you just haven't found them in this area. Yes. Well, could it be that all of the things that God does that we cannot explain, that you know perhaps all the reasons for them are in this section that you just don't know yet, that you just haven't discovered yet? Is that possible? The only answer to that is, well, of course that's possible. Well then, sir, you are not an atheist. You are perhaps, actually, an agnostic, because you admit that from what you don't know, there is a possibility of the existence of God and the reasoning of God in the knowledge that you just have not learned yet. Elihu's going to bring out this point, because though we might not understand God and know God and all of the ways and the reasons that God does his things, and he questions Job and Job has no answers, sometimes people today are led to believe that because we don't have all the answers, that is evidence that there is no such thing as God and that there is no God. In fact, I would argue the contrary. When we can't find the answers, sometimes it just points to the God of the Bible, because when we read about the God of the Bible, there is no possible way that we can understand and know everything there is to know about God. And if we ever got to a point where we claimed that, yes, you know, we have the answers and all the answers, then we aren't talking about the same God. The God that I know is demonstrated in his greatness and how far greater he is than us. And so, to be quite honest, everything there is to know about God will probably always remain in this section right here and will be revealed in the last time. I wish I had more time to talk about that, but I already went 3 minutes over. Blame my dad. Anyway, any last thoughts or questions? All right, we will pick up with God's interaction with Job next week.